It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the recently announced changes to the SAT college admission tests, including the removal of that essay requirement.
First, the winter of 2014 has been brutal by almost anyone's standards, and the low temperatures and ice cover on the lakes have been especially hard for ducks, in particular diving ducks.
Diving ducks like mergansers, common goldeneyes, and redheads are used to diving below the surface to hunt for food. This year, the ice cover is making that job a lot harder.
Scott Deal is with us now as the wildlife manager for the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center at the Wisconsin Humane Society in Milwaukee. He's been working to restore sick and injured diving ducks back to health. Scott, thanks for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, Scott, why has this year been so hard for diving ducks?
The extensive ice cover on rivers, streams, lakes, especially the Great Lakes for these guys, has really been the source of their misery.
And when ducks get into trouble, what happens? Is there a typical thing that happens to a diving duck?
What's happening with these birds is, I think because the ice cover has been so extensive, and they're entirely dependent on, as you mentioned, foraging beneath the surface for fish or mollusks or whatever, with very limited locations in which they can forage, they've gotten pretty thin and pretty desperate. And what they're doing, it seems, is they're landing on roadways, wet or icy parking lots. I think given the right lighting circumstances, those surfaces look like a glistening river or pond to these birds. And they're so desperate for food that they are going to strange locations looking for food.
And I heard that you found some ducks that were literally frozen to the ice. What happened?
Oh, that was several weeks ago when the temperatures were, I think, like 16 below zero. And we had it pretty cold. I'm sure everyone remembers those days. Someone down at the Lake Michigan shoreline here in Milwaukee was looking at some of the strange ice formations forming on the shoreline, and they looked down and happened to see two mergansers who were one on top of the other and literally frozen to the ice on one of these formations at the shoreline.
And what happens then? How do you help them?
Well, we were, with the help of one of our trained rescue volunteers, another staff person, and I went down there, and we were able to use some of the lake water to ladle it over the frozen feet and feathers of these birds, and by working them by hand, actually get them freed from the ice. Unfortunately, the one that was on the bottom of the stack was already deceased, but we were ultimately able to release the surviving bird.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, what I've seen online is that the birding listservs and websites are sort of alive with these stories of people who are seeing sick and stranded and injured ducks. So let's say someone comes across a bird like this. What do they do?
Ideally, the best thing to do is to call a local licensed wildlife rehabilitator for their advice. And now sometimes these cases are, they're in a spot that's dangerous for them. Several of the birds that we've admitted have been hit by cars after they've landed in the road, and they're not good at standing and walking and can't take off from land, and they end up getting hit by a car or in some cases attacked by a predator. So in those cases, be careful, be safe, watch for traffic and so on. But getting the bird off the roadway, and you can use a jacket or a blanket to toss it over the bird and then pick it up and contain it in a cardboard box with a few small air holes poked in it, or a pet carrier or something like that. And then call a local wildlife rehabilitator for advice.
And let's say someone lives near you guys in Milwaukee and they drop off the bird with you or you come get it. What do you do to rehabilitate these ducks?
It's supportive care first. It's an exam, first a physical exam to see what's going on. And some of these birds have had, as I mentioned, fractures. So we've had broken wings, broken legs. Internal fractures is what we call things like broken coracoid bones or furculas, you know, the wishbone of a bird, or their keel, their breastbone. All of them are in various states of emaciation. They're usually 30 or 40% underweight and dehydrated. And so we will triage them, look them over, examine them for other problems besides the expected emaciation, dehydration. And then it's supportive care. If they're in really bad shape, they go into an isolette, essentially a used, donated human baby incubator that we keep some of the birds in. Or they'll be in a another habitat, small habitat cage, if you will, that has we make water beds by using zip-top food storage bags and put a light cloth over that. It's really important to keep these birds from developing lesions, pressure sores on their keel bone and on their feet, because really they're, other than going ashore to nest or occasionally to loaf around a little bit, they spend all of their time on the water, and they're really adapted for water. And so when they get on a hard surface, a relatively hard surface on the ground or a cage floor in this case, just like humans, if you were limited to a hospital bed lying on your back, you might get bed sores, pressure sores on your tailbone or whatever. And the same happens to these birds, albeit on their keel or on their feet. So we have to protect against that.
So lots of stuff you're doing to nurse them back to health. And as far as people who want to help, maybe wildlife in general or these ducks in particular, you know, short of just bringing them in, if they just want to help them out there on the lakes as they're looking for food, is there anything that we can do?
Well, we saw a great story about someone, I believe it was in Manitowoc, who had access to an icebreaker, and they actually went out and broke up ice for some of the free-ranging birds that have not, you know, succumbed to making a mistake about, like, landing in a street and ending up in a rehab center. So that's a really cool thing to do. Most of us don't have that ability, but we are a nonprofit organization, not funded by tax dollars. So donations, and it's real easy to donate on our website. And our website's www.wihumane.org. We're really going through the extra amounts of hot water and doing lots of laundry, lots of padding for cage floors to protect the birds, and lots of food, buying smelt by the 125-pound block. So that sort of thing would be super, super helpful.
Well, and the goal, is what you've said, is to release the ducks back into the wild. Can you leave us with a story about a duck or two that made it?
Oh, sure. Well, it's great to just see them day by day, and you know, they come in presented with, they're really hopeless, because once some of these guys hit the ground or end up in a snowbank, they just can't take off again, so they would have certainly died. But to bring them through, you know, the initial tough stage and watch them day by day start to eat and keep themselves clean and so on, and then be able to take them out to the lake shore and open your hands up and have them fly away and see them sail toward a horizon or sail out. There was one red-breasted merganser that we released a couple of weeks ago, and to watch it take off and fly probably 200 yards and land among some of its own kind out on Lake Michigan was really, really fun.
Excellent. Well, Scott, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about the ducks and how they're doing.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
We've been talking to Scott Deal, Wildlife Manager for the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center at the Wisconsin Humane Society.
Major changes are coming to the SAT college admissions test. Announced yesterday, the overhauled test would be put in place in 2016, meaning today's ninth graders would be the first group of students to take a crack at it.
Under the new test, students would not be required to write an essay, and a rule that deters random guessing is going away, too. Some see the changes as an attempt to keep pace with the ACT, which has been more popular in recent years.
Joining us now to talk about the updated test is Nick Anderson, higher education reporter at the Washington Post. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, this is the second time the SAT has gotten a redesign lately. Why now?
Well, the SAT, which is overseen by the College Board, is in a period of transition. Back in 2005, they added a required essay and writing section. They also did a number of other things to the test that year to change its format, change its focus. They made it a 2,400-point test instead of 1,600 points. Mm-hmm. It was longer. It went from 3 hours to 3 hours and 45 minutes. They advertised it then as sort of a way to kind of put the SAT more relevant into the classroom. But the funny thing happened was that the essay was got a lukewarm reception. It never really got a lot of traction in the college admissions community. A lot of college admissions officers looked at it kind of as not very significant in their overall thinking about applications. It's a 25-minute essay under time, and the College Board itself looked at the essay and said, it's not as substantial as we want it to be. It's not as good as we want it to be. So all those things were kind of floating around in people's minds for the last few years, and a new president of the College Board, his name is David Coleman, he came on board in 2012. He's one of the architects of the Common Core State Standards, which we can talk about in a second, that affects the K-12 system. Mm-hmm. Coleman came in to the College Board and said, let's do something about this. So what we see now is the result of his imperative to do something. It's a test that aims to be, in his words, sort of stripped of the tricks and much more straightforward and relevant, asking students to analyze evidence and come to the test knowing that if they've done the hard work in high school, that's going to be assessed.
Well, and hearing his language as he speaks about it, he's talking about how the current test and past tests have advantaged kids from wealthier families,
right,
especially those who could afford test prep. He seemed really worked up about this. Why is that so important to him?
Well, folks in education, he's not the only one who thinks this is a huge issue. I mean, there's a lot of folks in education who are giving very hard thought to what to do to eliminate disadvantages that are grounded in people's household income and people's household education. You know, if your mom and dad went to college, that's a big predictor in whether you're going to college. If your mom and dad have household income above a certain amount, that's a big predictor in whether you might go to college. And, you know, so the SAT and the College Board and the ACT, for that matter, and colleges around the country are kind of scratching their heads and saying, well, what can we do about this? The thing that the College Board announced yesterday that really got a lot of people's attention is they are going to offer free test preparation through an online service called the Khan Academy. Now, most middle-class to upper-middle-class families feel squeezed with college test prep. They, you know, it's expensive, but they feel like they really need to lay down some money to send their kids to these test prep classes so that their kids can get a slightly better score. And if they get a slightly better score, well, that might be the thing that tips them into the slightly better college, into being accepted to those colleges. So there's this kind of economic imbalance in the test prep industry that's kind of built into the SAT and the ACT. And so the College Board yesterday announced this initiative that's aimed to try to redress that. Who knows if it'll work?
Let's get into some of the changes. You mentioned the essay is gone. You talked a little bit about why. Now, one of the changes involves guessing and less of a penalty for guessing on questions, I guess?
Yeah. Let me just correct the impression here. The essay is not gone. It's just been made optional.
The required essay, I should have said.
So there will be a lot of colleges that will still require it, and it's going to be 50 minutes, not 25. We can talk about that later, but the essay is not gone. It's just optional. So here's what they're doing with the scoring. In previous years and currently, if you guess on a multiple-choice question on the SAT, you risk getting a penalty. Now, the SAT, the advice on this is if you can eliminate one of the multiple-choice answers or two, then maybe it's worth making the guess. But if it's a random guess, you're not necessarily going to win by taking a random guess because you get deducted 1/4 point for every wrong answer in the multiple-choice sections. That's a difference, a key difference between the SAT and the ACT. The ACT doesn't have that kind of penalty. You just get credit for right answers. You don't get any deduction for wrong answers. So the College Board announced that they're getting rid of that. People I talked to today say, hey, this is a big relief because, you know, that fear of getting a penalty for guessing, that kind of throws people off their stride as they're racing through a test. It adds a kind of psychological factor in the test that you don't necessarily want if you just want to be, you know, thinking clearly and as fast as you can.
Another change I've heard when I remember prepping for these tests, there are the SAT words you would only ever encounter in preparing for this test. The one I remember is inchoate, amorphous or not fully formed. Never had cause to use it outside of that test. Are they moving away from those words now?
Yeah. Now, they are very deliberately moving away from them. They're actually not putting out a list of words that they're getting rid of, which I think would probably be dangerous because the English teachers of America would be up in arms, and a lot of other people would be. But you can probably guess at what some of these words are. I took a stab at trying to figure it out. I mean, the word phlegmatic, the word punctilious. Another English teacher suggested to me the word ambergris. I mean,
See, now I want to use all these words.
Yeah, they're beautiful words. I do, too. Matter of fact, I was pondering yesterday whether to put the word esoteric in my story, and an editor and I discussed it, and we thought, well, let's just replace that word and put in the word fancy. Because, you know, the point here is, and we writers deal with this all the time, is that, you know, language is best when it's simple and clear and understandable as writers. That doesn't mean you get rid of the fancy words, but you use them sparingly. And you don't want the fancy words to be barriers to people unnecessarily when something's as high stakes as whether they can get a good score for college. So that's the theory here, is to just strip the test of the super fancy, super arcane words and have tough words still in the test, but tough words that are meaningful and that they're likely to encounter and use and wrestle with in school.
And then another change you mentioned back in the day, the perfect score, the perfect game was 1,600,
yeah.
And they're going back to that now. Why 2,400 back to 1,600?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about this. 1,600 just echoes a lot in our society. People recognize that. The SAT has been, for most of its history, the dominant college test. And for most of that history, when it was the dominant college test, people just had an instant recognition of, 1,600, wow, that's an amazing score. And, you know, it's recognizable. It's a brand, in a way. It's a brand builder for the SAT, the number 1,600. It's not 1,600, it's 1,600. Mm-hmm. So people recognize it. Now, in 2005, when they added that required essay and they added the writing section in the required essay, they added 800 points, and all of a sudden, perfection became 2,400, not 1,600. Not so many people recognize 2,400. Now, maybe they're starting to, but I think going back to 1,600 is sort of a recognition on the College Board's part that 1,600 is a recognizable and useful tool.
We're talking about the upcoming changes to the SAT college exams, which were just announced. Our guest is Nick Anderson, higher education reporter at The Washington Post.
And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think of the changes to the SAT? Do you think they go far enough in addressing concerns that the test is shutting out less affluent students? And do you think tests like the SAT and the ACT are really the best measure of college preparedness? Maybe there's one you think is a better indicator. Call us at 1-800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Washington Post education reporter Nick Anderson about the recently announced changes to the SAT college exam, including the removal of the requirement to do the essay and a return of the old perfect score, 1600.
You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about the changes, and what do you think of tests like the SAT and the ACT? Do they predict college success? And if not, what do you think we should be looking to? 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Nick, what's the reaction been to these changes since they were announced?
Well, there's a couple things. Number one, there's a fairly significant movement among some colleges to not require the SAT or the ACT, okay? So there's colleges out there. American University here in Washington is one I talked to, Wake Forest University, Bates College, and a number of others. There's a list that indicates maybe about 800 colleges admits a substantial number of students without requiring tests. Now, by no means is this the majority, but there's a movement out there. And so the folks who hear the SAT revisions, and they're coming from the point of view of that movement, they say, well, you know, you're just fiddling with something that, frankly, is just simply an obstacle. Why even use these tests? So that's one reaction. Another reaction is from the ACT, okay, which is the big rival.
The rival,
to the SAT.
Yeah.
And the ACT in your state, in Wisconsin, is far more widely used. Far more widely used. We're talking about like on an order of 20 to 1 in terms of the number of students who, for every 20 students, one who take the ACT, one's taken the SAT in Wisconsin. And there are a number of states around the country where this is the case, where the ACT has just simply locked down the market share. So, you know, the reaction from that quarter is kind of a shrug of the shoulders, like, okay, College Board, say what you want, but, you know, we're an ACT state. Or if you're the ACT, you might say, okay, College Board, say what you want, but we're the ACT, we're going to keep doing what we do.
Let's go to our callers. We've got Joe on the line in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. So I graduated in 1970, and I think I took the Iowa Basic Skills Test. I assume it's similar to the SATs. And I don't recall any preparation for it. We just took the test. And what I think's happened is it's become a marker for the teaching ability of the district and the individual teachers versus a marker of how much the student has learned. Hmm. You know, it's almost like the preparation seems to me like cliff notes for the kids on how to pass the test. I think it's a problem for education.
Joe, thanks for the call. There's a couple different kind of tests there, I think he's talking about. But the rise of the concept of preparation in the industry around it, Nick.
Yeah. Well, the caller puts his finger on an interesting point, which is that really the most important test preparation is great schools. You know, great schools, great teaching, great, you know, strong learning. That's test preparation. You know, and a lot of the test prep firms, you know, they're very clear that their job is not to sort of deliver content. Their job is to kind of help students navigate the tricks. And as pressure has grown in college applications to certain selective schools, everybody's looking for the tricks. Everybody wants a little edge, you know, and they figure that if the SAT score goes up 20 or 40 points, or if their ACT score goes up a point or two, that that somehow that will be the magic edge that gets them in to whatever school it is. So that's why the test prep. But the caller is absolutely right that, you know, great teaching, great, you know, strong learning, that's the most important prep of all.
Before I let you go, when I took the SAT, it was a must-do, and the ACT for that matter. You had to do it if you were thinking of ever going to any college everywhere. Yeah. You mentioned more colleges moving away from requiring those. Is this discussion we're having going to become less and less relevant in the years to come?
Well, that's a great point. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to see these tests disappearing. It's maybe they will, but I doubt it. You know, a lot of the conversation about education in this country is driven by sort of the pursuit of the elite. People want to get into the very best schools, whatever those are and however they define them. And in order to do that, they have to apply. And in order to apply, there's many, many people who apply. And in order to differentiate all those applicants, colleges rely a little bit on test scores. Sometimes they rely a lot on them. And I don't see that going away. But there's some colleges that have explicitly made the leap to do so, and I think they're kind of trying to carve out a market niche. It's all about market position. And those colleges that are test optional, they're saying, hey, look at us. You know, you don't need to do all that stress. You can just, you know, be a great student with great grades and come to us.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
We've been talking about the recently announced changes to the SAT with Nick Anderson, higher education reporter at The Washington Post.
There's a lot of gloom and doom when we talk about the United States Postal Service, it seems. For years, we've seen stories about the agency posting huge losses, as well as declining mail volume and the possible elimination of Saturday delivery. But our next guest says there's something we can do about it.
The idea: let the post office become a bank. He says that by offering basic banking services to customers like savings accounts, debit cards, maybe even simple loans, we could save the post office and solve a lot of other problems plaguing the country.
Joining us now is David Dayton. He's a freelance writer and a contributor to Salon. We've got a link to his recent piece, How the Post Office Could Save the Economy and Change Your Life, on the Central Time Facebook page. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, you point out that the idea of postal banking isn't that new, but why is this the right time to be thinking about it again?
The time is right because there are 1 in 4 households in America, roughly, I believe around 28%, who either are unbanked, which means they don't have a bank account at all, or they are underbanked, which means they may have a bank account, but they lack stable access to financial services and use other alternative financial services. And these alternatives charge a huge premium to use these services. The average family who is unbanked or underbanked and makes probably about $25,000 a year spends $2,400 a year, or about 10% of their total income, on these alternative financial services, just to cash a check, get a small loan, or things of that nature. So if the post office, which has a history of offering these kinds of financial services, simply would do that, they could save billions of dollars for these families who are, you know, at the invulnerable edges of society, and also help with the postal finances, although I would argue that the financial inclusion aspect is far more important.
We did have postal banking in the past, it seems. Why did it go away?
Well, there were postal savings accounts from 1911 to 1967. They earned about 2% interest, and at the time, savings and loans were offering much more in interest throughout the 1960s, and so they lost their market share. But the Postal Service did not really end giving financial services. You can still get a money order at the post office. In 9 Latin American countries, you can do international money transfers through a system they have called Dinero Seguro. And so there are this remnants of postal banking, postal financial services being offered. And because of that, the Inspector General of the Post Office, who wrote a very remarkable paper, a white paper about this, says that this could occur, the Postal Service could explore this under their existing authority because they're already serving the public with certain kinds of financial services.
Seems like it would be a pretty big cultural shift at this point for people to do banking at the post office. How would we go about making that happen?
Well, I think it would be kind of a natural shift. Many countries around the world offer postal services. In fact, when the post office did offer a savings account, the number one group of people who used it were recent immigrants. And so I think that it would certainly be a better option for people who are unbanked and underbanked than having to go to a check cashing store or a payday lender. I think the cultural shift there would be very positive for those people who are being gouged, really, by these abusive, some would say, alternative financial services. They could save billions of dollars, and the post office, which is already a trusted source in most communities in America, would benefit from the increased services.
Do you have any idea how the post office itself might feel about this idea of adopting a banking aspect of their business?
Well, as I said, the Inspector General of the U.S. Postal Service has endorsed the practice. Some policymakers have also endorsed the practice. One problem right now is that the Board of Governors, which is the body that governs the Postal Service, it sets policy, it picks the Postmaster General, there are five vacancies on that board. So we don't know who will be picked for that board in the future and whether they would be receptive to this idea. But I will say that if the idea is that in an age of email, that mail volume is simply going to shrink over time, then the Postal Service has really two options. Either they can sort of shrink their footprint, or they could explore additional revenue streams. And considering that they have 35,000 different locations in every community in America, and in fact, 58% of all post offices are in zip codes that have zero or one bank branches in them. These are bank deserts, basically. The banking industry is basically pulled up out of low-income and rural communities. And the post office offers an alternative here. So you have this physical infrastructure, you have personnel, you have the trust of the nation. Why not offer services that aren't being offered by the traditional banking system?
Well, I want to dig into some of the advantages that you say postal banking would bring. One claim that you make is pretty dramatic. You say postal banking could end recessions. How would that work?
Well, it's a bit far afield, but the idea of a postal account, which could be given sort of automatically to everyone with a Social Security number, would have some benefit if there was a recession. And instead of doing the kind of monetary policy that the Federal Reserve does right now, which is trying to increase asset prices and lower long-term mortgage rates, they could simply say, all right, we're going to put $200 in the postal accounts when there's a recession, and you need to spend that in the next month or it goes away. And what that would do would create a timely and targeted stimulus. You know, I mean, in 2008, George Bush, I remember getting my check in the mail, which was an attempted stimulus for the economy. The postal account could deliver this much more efficiently and have the ability to really target that at the people who need it as sort of a stimulus for Main Street instead of Wall Street. So that's the idea behind that.
Okay, and there's another one that you write about, and this targets identity theft. And mm-hmm. You say that America is the place where half the identity theft in the world happens, and that kind of consumer fraud like we saw with Target recently. And the post office is ready-made to advance to a card with a chip right in it, and it could be at the vanguard of changing the way we do business in that sense.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the problems is that the banking system is sort of entrenched in delivering these credit and debit cards that have a magnetic stripe on them, which are very easily hacked. They're very easily copied. and things like that. Most of the world has gone to a chip structure, which also you have to use a PIN number, a personal identification number, in order to make a purchase. Since the post office has no existing sort of infrastructure with their cards, they could immediately go to chip and PIN and bring the rest of the retail world along, which I believe is where they want to go. If you listen to the National Federation of Retailers, they want to move to a more secure system. It makes sense for everybody, especially with the reputational loss of something like Target, which has really damaged their own reputation. So having the Postal Service jumpstart this process, I think, would be very beneficial.
And it sounds like they would have an ATM in there, and you could perform most basic banking functions there. Do you see this as something that's primarily aimed at lower-income people and people, as you say, in banking deserts? Or would this be something that could go kind of mainstream and be for all strata of society?
Well, I mean, I don't think that the post office would certainly turn down additional business, but I do see it as an opportunity to serve communities whose needs aren't being met right now by the traditional banking system. If banks wanted to deliver accounts and loans and things like that into these communities, they'd be doing it right now. They feel like it's either not profitable for them or for whatever reason, they're not doing it. And so I think instead of trying to regulate these payday lenders and check cashing stores that inevitably are very slippery and get through cracks in the law, it's better that instead of using regulation, let's use competition. And the competition could be from a publicly provided service, a public option for simple banking. And the post office could deliver it. And if people are interested in moving their money into a public agency instead of the traditional banking system, then so be it.
Now, how big an investment do you see this as being, and how soon a timeline toward the post office turning a profit?
Well, the post office could explore this through a pilot program tomorrow. They have the existing authority through their continuing relationship through the use of money orders and the use of already existing financial services. They could try this in a few communities and see if the public is receptive to it. In terms of turning a profit, the biggest problem with the post office right now in terms of their profits is that they are required by law to pre-fund retirement benefits 75 years out, which is something no public agency or private business has to do, fund the retirement of people they've never even hired yet or who aren't even born yet. So the big problem with the post office that needs to be solved is eliminating this kind of crisis mentality that were it not for this pre-funding requirement, the post office would be profitable today. So in terms of being profitable with banking in the future, I think it does help go down that road over time, especially if it catches on. I mean, in the 1940s, 4 million people had a postal banking account, and that's really a floor for, I think, what you could see here. I think the people who are tired of being gouged by either alternative financial services or their own bank would welcome a new option for themselves.
David, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your idea.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to David Dayan, a freelance writer and contributor to Salon. We've got a link to his recent piece, How the Post Office Could Save the Economy and Change Your Life, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, if we hear somebody wins the lottery twice or gets struck by lightning twice or flips a coin and comes up heads 100 times in a row, what do we make of that? Is this an unusual event? Yes, but unusual events like that happen all the time, according to our next guest, the author of The Improbability Principle, coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.